Welcome, everybody, to Connecting the Dots with me and Kelly. It became solstice this week. Just occurred to me. I was trying to think, what time of year is this? Yes, kids are almost out of school, or mine are almost out. And so we agreed on a... Oh, and by the way, just to say now, because we'll forget it later, we will not be having one of these during the rest of the summer, so during July and August, and then we'll resume in September with date and title to be announced. Today, how do I want to start this? Because I'm gonna start out. For those of you who haven't listened before, or even if you've listened, you might not be aware that the way it's evolved is that either Kelly or I kind of proposes a topic, and then we both think about it, and we decide on how we want to go about it. And so this one was mine. It's called, log jams, or it's basically dealing with log jams. And so what do I mean by that? First, just backing up a little about where it comes from in me, two places. One is that I do a lot of my work, 4 or 5 times a week, is consultation to complicated, difficult treatment situations in community mental health in Massachusetts. So I just do a lot of that right now, and have for years. And it's not any one model. It isn't. I use DBT sometimes. I use psychoanalytic frame of reference sometimes. I use family frames of reference. I use community psychiatry, etc. But it's really more just trying to. It just seems like one terrible situation after another arrives with a group of people, and I go to work trying to assess what's the story and what can be done. And sometimes it's ones where there have been other consultations and so on. And so one of the metaphors, I work a lot. I'm aware a lot of using metaphors in my work, in therapy and in consultation. And some metaphors just seem bigger than others for me, and different ones, I suppose, mm-hmm. would be different, bigger for different people. But by that, I just mean it links an awful lot of things together and proves to be helpful in depicting what's going on and giving me some ideas about how to move and giving a framework of reference so that, 5, 10, 15, or 20 people sitting around the table can contribute and try to figure out how to move things along. So logjam is one of my favorite metaphors, because there are logjams at every level of society. There's log jams in our own personal lives. There's log jams in every family. There's log jams in the mental health treatment system. And so it just comes back to me time and time again. And the other reason it comes back to me is more of a personal note. I grew up in a small town of about 10,000 people in Oregon, Albany, Oregon. And it was very much in the 1950s, when I was a kid, was a very much of a lumber industry town. In fact, it had the best known lumber or timber carnival in the country. Took place in Albany every year when I was growing up, and it happened always right about this time of year, because it was always the first week of July. And lumberjacks would come from Canada and all over the U.S., northern U.S., and compete. And I would go every year, and my friends and I had heroes among the lumberjacks. We knew their names. We knew the all-around best lumberjacks, from this year and that year, the way people follow sports heroes. And I had a cousin in southern Oregon, a girl cousin, who then married a guy who worked in the lumber industry. And his job was that he would be out on rivers, and when there was a log jam, in getting the logs from where they were cut down to the mill, and these terrible log jams would happen, sometimes amazingly fast, and just build up from one log to another until there were literally almost millions of feet, of board feet, of lumber, essentially, that are tied up in the river and blocking the river and causing problems upstream and problems downstream and damaging the industry and ruining the company. And so it was a huge thing, and they would hire people to run around on the river on the logs to try to prevent log jams when they just started to happen, and then to try to get them apart once they did happen, which was much, much harder. And he had an instrument. He would run around with these spiked shoes and on these logs that are always, you know, potentially dangerous job, because, you know, sometimes one of the guys doing this job would slip through and never be seen again. And you'd carry this long pole with this metal spike that came out at a certain angle at the end. This pole was called a peavey. And the peavey was used to push and pull logs. It was just constructed for that purpose and to get things moving again. And those of you who really know DBT, I often have thought that the peavey is the perfect metaphor for the dialectical strategies, the ones where you use when things are get really stuck, you know, and you've got to get things moving again, and you've got to get speed, movement, and flow going, and you've got to perceive which log to push and how much to push and how little to push. It requires some nuance, some agility. And so the use of the PV in a life-threatening situation where you're running around trying to save the lumber industry in your area, it was really intense, and because of that, it was also a high-paying job. And so log jams, I was very familiar with log jams, and you guys can go on the internet if you want and look up famous log jams in history, just like famous hurricanes. It's not as well known now, but 100 years ago, log jams were followed the way hurricanes were followed, at least in the northern part of the United States and Canada. So there's where it comes from personally, so that's probably why it always has a grip on me, just thinking, you know, when I approach a treatment situation, when I approach a family where things are stuck, when I approach a patient, a treatment situation where it just seems like everything has gone bad, you know, the family situation is in trouble, the person's medical condition is bad, their psychiatric or psychological condition is bad, there's a reputation they have in the emergency room, the local doctors know about. It's just, you feel, once you just take a careful look at some of these situations, you feel like you are looking at a logjam that has already formed, and it's doing a lot of damage, and everybody's trying to cope with it in the best way that they can. And I just, one way that this metaphor helps me is that it helps me right away start thinking, okay, don't just jump in and start pushing logs around yet. You know, that you might make it worse. You could become the next log in the log jam. You bring in your treatment approach in a kind of a lockstep way without much real nuance and without much real observation of what's really going on and what led to what. And, you know, you just don't know. There's a chance that you're just going to make it worse. So one thing it helps me with is to help me stop and realize, just take your time. Sometimes insurance companies don't let you take your time in some situations, and hospitals don't let you take your time. But sometimes if you move too quickly, you really don't know what you're doing, and you make things worse. So one lesson for me is just, you know, to think of it as a log jam. That means to me there's a history to this log jam. There was a first log in this log jam. Then there was a second one and a third one. And the first log, let's say somebody got mistreated or hurt at a certain point in their life, and they weren't in a log jam at that point, but they got hurt. And then they, having been mistreated, they then had a reaction to that might have started to look like PTSD. And then somebody in their life didn't understand that and didn't know that's what was happening, didn't even get the story of what happened, and reacts a certain way that's very unsympathetic and just doesn't grasp what has happened. And whether on purpose or accidentally, and I think way more commonly accidentally, ends up sort of putting a log on that log. And you're still not in such bad shape if it was at that point. It's just early in the log jam. Like if you had a peavey at that point, or you just had a lot of water flowing, or you had sort of an observe people observing and being thoughtful about it, you then could maybe maneuver in a way that it would not develop into something bigger and more complicated. But rather quickly, as we all know, that can turn into a situation where, just like the ones I was mentioning before, where someone in the family now has an attitude about it, and they misunderstand what happened, and then someone in a treatment system doesn't get it, and then somebody blames somebody else for what happened, and it isn't quite right. And I think it's very common that logs get thrown on. Once log jams begin, people don't know what to do with it, and they throw logs on. And usually it's the logs of misunderstanding, the logs of invalidation, the logs of trying to force some approach, some attitude, some thought, some approach onto somebody, and it's a mismatch. And you get a few of these things going, and Linehan's idea of there is this biological reality at a given moment, biologically based emotional reality, and then if the environment reacts to it in a way that misunderstands it and is a mismatch and somehow makes it worse, that's throwing a log on to the log jam or beginning log jam. And then another one goes on, another goes on, and next thing you know, the whole family's at war, or they're not talking to each other anymore, and this person's getting no help. And then they have a medical condition that results from it. And then there's a divorce in the family, and then there's another thing. And next thing you know, it arrives on your doorstep. If the way it does on mine when I do consultations, you have no idea. It's important to remember that. All of your theories of what caused what in the situation really have to be put on the shelf as you just be with it, observe it, try not to add a log, try moving one log thoughtfully, see what happens. So, Kelly, there's a lot of actual problems, clinical problems, societal problems that this comes to my mind in response to. And so it's kind of a switch point for me when I start thinking that particular metaphor. And I've brought it up at consultations before when they've happened, and then ask people if they can identify the logs. And then, it's just one of many metaphors you can use, but it helps people think in a situation where they're afraid to blame somebody or blame themselves. Because they just were talking about a log jam in Oregon.
Yeah, no, I'm following you. I'm thinking it's a very powerful metaphor, and the pressure, having seen pictures, the way that things pile up and the pressure and the urgency, I think is another way that the metaphor at least works for me. How many pulp, how many parted it is, how much, sheer, I think courage it takes to get out into when you're describing your cousin, the courage to actually get out into that is it's difficult. It's actually dangerous in some ways to really, I think, for tolerating that things all hell can break loose,
It's true.
That's,
I think when you have a logjam situation, you actually have it isn't that you, things look like they're at a standstill, but actually within that standstill are sometimes overwhelming force that are there. I mean, it's basically wars within a person, within a system, within a family, that are just everything stuck. So untangling it is very, to be out on it like my cousin would be, I mean, running around is one thing. You have to have a lot of agility in the moment, but also that doesn't quite capture the other skill that's needed in looking at these things, which is to understand the architecture of a log jam. the underlying, the dynamics of a logjam. What's pushing what? What's fighting what? Who's standing for this position and who's standing for this position? And I think family therapists have often been at the forefront, I think, of grasping that the presentation at the moment in what looks like a complete standstill is masking that, you know, that there's a really, you know, that that the identified patient is just one log in the logjam. And so you really step back from it and don't, you know, almost always your first instinct is going to be wrong, in my experience of these things, because if they're really terrible, you want to jump and do something. You want to point your finger at somebody. You want to get action going, and important to get action going. But I think it's kind of like watching yourself have the urge to untangle a logjam and then realize that you haven't stopped and just listened to everybody. I think a lot of times when, you know, you have a treatment system, is say, I mean, whether it's psychoanalytic treatment system like the first one I learned with Kernberg, or Linehan's, or mentalization-based therapy, or any other therapy for borderline personality disorder, a logjam has happened. Everybody's in pain. Everybody's feeling a little bit hopeless, or a lot hopeless. Everybody feels kind of stuck, and it's hard to get out of it. It's terrible. And then they come and see a professional. And I think when you just try to impose a model before you've figured out something about it or being open to it, it can be hard unless you apply the model in a very big-minded way. You can get stuck yourself trying to do something because you think you see what should be done. This situation, this person needs skills. I once had somebody sent to me to learn skills because it looked to the people that were treating that person like skills would make the difference. And after I treated this person for 3 or 4 sessions, without going into the details about it, what the circumstances of that person's point of view and the problem was such that she was nowhere near. And actually, by even getting it going in that direction with such force, it just added another log. And I'm not blaming us for adding logs. You know, you can't get involved with this work without doing things that become part of the problem before they become part of the solution. With that person, it turned out I had... What?
Well, I was going to say, give me some examples. Yeah.
Okay. There was quite some time ago, I did a consult where it was a young man, and it appeared that he might have had his first episode of a psychotic episode, maybe a schizophrenic illness, but it wasn't clear. There were a lot of people at the table. Family members, the patient himself, a bunch of treaters in the particular system he was in, and everybody wanted. It had been about 1 year into, I think, the beginning of a logjam, and where things had been going okay. And then they started to go badly, and then they went worse, and they went worse, and without going into details that would be identifying, it became, you know, so that all came when we had the meeting. So first of all, it was important to have a long enough meeting without having too forceful an agenda. So we had a 2-hour meeting where it was just possible to sit and try to look and untangle the logjam. And by the end of the meeting, it was becoming clear that a lot of people had played a part in this. It's always the case. There was a whole background story to it. That's always the case. There's always a log-by-log history. And then the question was, is there anything that can be done that's not likely to make things worse and that is likely to open up a small step. It's like finding the log that can still be moved in the right direction to start to undo the pile. And maybe you'll even find one that other logs are resting on. So it turned out that if you get a group of people thinking in a collaborative and willing way, rather than fighting about this, you know, people start to brainstorm and they start to say things. So somebody turned out this person had a particular skill throughout his adolescence of fixing a certain kind of thing. And he always liked to do that, and he always had these things around. And so somebody said, well, what if we set him up, helped him out? What do you think? Would you like to be able to do that and make some money doing that? Well, this little log, this move to give him something going turned out to create a whole unpacking of the logjam over the next 3 or 4 months. He thought it was a great idea, and it actually had credibility to it. And actually, there was a state agency willing to fund a little of it, and it started to move. So that's the kind of thing I think that comes mm-hmm. out. Now, how did that happen? It happened because everybody stepped back together and adopted the posture of, we're looking at a log jam, and we're all part of it. And how can we start to unpack it? What can we possibly do? I didn't use that metaphor out loud in that meeting, but that's the kind of thing, is that when you start to figure that out, and it might be the addition of somebody. I like to have a lot of people at the table to brainstorm these things, because then you bring more diversity of opinions. You have, you know, more people. There's less likely to be this kind of culture of unspoken blaming among this one versus that one. You know, you can kind of move away from that and have a broader discussion about what could possibly be done. And it mobilizes people. So I think it's getting the people who are actually, some of them, part of the logjam, giving them the opportunity to collaborate, but with this idea of a metaphor that helps them start to see. So that was one where everybody thought, this got stuck. This guy was on his way to something. And then whatever happened, is this like the sort of coming into being of a set of symptoms, totally stopped the whole development of his work life, which may have been about to take off. And so just going back to that was like, okay, that one thing, and this is where I find the metaphor doesn't quite do justice to the fact that you don't always need to spend 5 years unpacking log by log. If you start to get a little movement going, like a trickle, like a move, you know, some water moves through the log jam. Now it picks up 3 more logs on the way. Mm-hmm. Or the architecture shifts. If you just start, I've just seen this so many times with doing consultations where one small thing comes out of it. But if it's the right small thing, it actually creates a whole movement, like an avalanche of logjam breaking activity. That's one example. There's I wonder if you have thoughts about how you see it in your work life or your life. Begin to take this.
It makes me think of situations where, you know, it's like, where do you start? The term wicked problems is sometimes used in science and in business to refer to things where there's many, many interdependencies. Mm-hmm. I'm thinking about somebody I was working with where, you know, no matter which way you moved, it created a different set of problems that were all themselves very complicated. So she was living in a residential place, but the residential place was so loud and chaotic that, in fact, it set off all kinds of problems. And the staff turnover was really high, and so she couldn't get the help that she needed. As soon as she'd get somebody who was kind of trained up to make it work. But on the flip side, to ask her parents for money was hugely humiliating, and it was going to end up causing a whole other set of problems. Mm-hmm. And so she could have her own place. And yet some of the social skills deficits she had really kept her from being able to launch into the type of work that would have given her enough money to pull it off on her own. So it's like,
exactly,
no matter which way she moved, it was
right.
It wasn't just a little problem. It was like a big interconnected set of problems. I think the thought I'm having is, you know, the hopelessness that one can feel. It's like, okay, so if you move a little, it's still not really sufficient, you know? And it takes, it feels like forever when you're really in it before something changes enough that you can see it. So it's very, you know, it's a very hard space to work in.
But Kelly, you know, what I like the way you just put that, and I just counter it a little bit, is that like when you take a situation like what you just described, and there's so many like that, where there is all the interdependent things, and to move to the right causes trouble, to move to the left causes trouble. It's real, you know, all of those people, for instance, that have Social Security, and if they move just enough to get just enough of a job, they lose their Social Security. That's just something I deal with all the time. That's just a societally based, you know, structure, reinforcement structure that's really unfortunate the way it works. And but there's so many things like that. But my experience is that the difference between not being able to move at all and being able to move, you know, one part of one limb, one piece of the logjam, can be a big difference. I mean, you can really go from no hope to at least being able to do something. And and when you've been starved for hope and somebody says, hey, how about if you try this? And then three people get behind it, and then a little bit of funding gets behind it, or some advocacy group gets behind it if it's that kind of a social issue, or something like NEABPD gets behind it. But in a clinical situation, if just things move a little bit, you know, it's like I was once during my time in New York, I spent a couple of years going to the Ackerman Family Institute to learn family therapy, at least the models that were being taught there, and I was in this class. Some people on the phone might know who this is. You know, Kelly, I always like to have the fantasy that there are actually people listening on the phone, and so they're all muted. Could be thousands of people. It's hundreds of thousands, and so somebody probably knows what I'm talking about. And so I was at this class was this wonderful family therapist, Olga Silverstein, and she was seeing a family from New York, and it was a family of two kids and two adults, and it came in, there was a log jam, and it looked like the log jam problem was that the boy wouldn't go to school, and it was, everybody was in really upset. It was a family that really valued education, and the boy was doing the one thing that just drove everybody nuts, and then was causing everybody to fight with everybody else, and everybody was at a standstill. Everybody was getting upset about it, and for quite a while, and they came in, and actually, you know, when I saw it, I thought, oh, boy, here's how we would do this back at the ranch where I was learning and doing, you know, psychoanalytic treatment of some things like this, but it was wonderful to see what she did, and I learned so much because she just, of course, first of all, she didn't have too much to do with the boy. She just talked with the parents about all kinds of things. And I think what she did was she surveyed the logjam without grabbing the most obvious log that was right there, like talking to the boy. And what family therapists would call talking to the identified patient, but I'd call it talking to the sticking out log in this metaphor and grabbing it. And so she just didn't grab that log. She just sort of kept surveying the situation, and she created a kind of an atmosphere of collaborative discussion that wasn't going to go at the problem with the boy. And within about three sessions, two things happened. One was the boy quietly, nobody even told her that week, had started going back to school for the first time in months. He just started going to school and was doing well. but at the same time, the father moved into the attic because it turned out that for a long time there was a silent logjam building in the father, that he was fed up with his life with the family. And so he was just not, he was just suddenly something, she, by doing something that was really rather subtle, and it was partly just the way she handled the whole cast of characters, movement happened. And that's what I find is sometimes it's, you know, I have one of these coming tomorrow. I have one every Monday. I have a 2-hour consult every Monday that starts the weekend. You know, I just read this stuff earlier today. I thought, and once again, I read these things, I think, oh my God, what am I going to do about this? And to help out, everything's been tried. But in fact, what will happen if we create the right atmosphere of just surveying the pressures, the logjam, the possibilities, and if you don't bite too quickly and you don't impose an approach too quickly, you know, movement will start to happen in the second half of the meeting and someone's going to say something. Often you have no idea who it's going to be, but somebody says something, and it might be somebody who's the frontline clinical staff person, the outreach worker, a vocational counselor or something, that makes an observation that suddenly sounds like a way out or a way to go, and then things can change. So I just think things can go that way. On the other hand, you sometimes can do these things and then nothing happens for a while. But it is one of these things. There was a family therapy saying, and I was studying that, about the more things change, the more they stay the same. And I think the more you try to change things really fast, sometimes it looks pretty good for a minute. But actually, it usually doesn't keep moving like that. You have to have a deeper grasp of what's going on. You have to be able to do what my cousin could do, run around on the logs, but you also had to be able to have an aerial photograph of what's going on.
Was it an aerial photograph that they used to use to decide where to work? How did they know where to go?
Well, it wasn't an aerial photograph before there were planes, now that I think of it, because this all got going in the 17 and 1800s, especially the 1800s. There's a lot of history written about log jamming, and there were the names for what my cousin did. They were called, log drivers, and another name was river pigs, and they didn't have PVs yet. They had other instruments. So in the 1800s, I don't think they did that, but they did. People started writing about, you know, needing to look at the pressure points in a log jam and look at the overall structure of it, look at the architecture of it. And I don't know. My image of that is aerial photograph, and I'm sure that sometimes that was the case, especially there was a devastating one in Michigan that's in the history books, and I think maybe considered the biggest one that ever took place. So you had these gigantic ones that where I think people just really had to look at them, and they took a long time to unpack them. You know, and it also was luck. You know, if the river surged, you know, you'd have a chance. But you know, so that part of the metaphor works too. Sometimes, really, you just get lucky. Things happening.
Well, it made me just wonder because of lucky, but then, you know, how do you create a surge, you know, where you can raise? I'm just thinking it made me think of, you know, that unexpected friend who shows up, you know, or a potential friend or romantic person, where it gives the person just enough energy that it raises the boat, or, you know, you lose the job. And that actually gives you just enough freedom to then actually take care of your health stuff. So you regain your health, which then puts you in a better, you know, like it's so complicated sometimes.
No, it's true. But, you know, it is that complicated. And I guess one of the points, my risk of doing this tonight is having this conversation where it feels like, well, what data is this attached to? And what is the model here that we're talking about? But I'm really moving in this conversation more into metaphor and an interventional focus rather than any model or any data or what exactly to do. And I do think that if you really treasure generating willingness among people and generating collaboration and getting more people at the table sometimes and getting the right people at the table sometimes and have a discussion about something. You know, like I did a consultation not too long ago about it. It was a family with another young man that seems to have begun to have a really chronic mental illness now. And it's just been devastating. It's just devastating. I mean, all of your life hopes and dreams look like they're just not going to work, and both for the kid and the parents and other people. And so this was happening, and I had this consult, and they were all at the table, and including some staff people and stuff. And they, by the end of the meeting, and there was an extended family member at the meeting that asked toward the end of the meeting, said, "There must be other families that have dealt with this." And he himself was a kind of an academic person. He was really smart, but kind of out of touch and removed in certain ways. But he was really smart and intuitive in other ways. And he had never faced a situation like this. "There must be other people. Do you know anyone else we can talk to?" And I said, "Well, both there are, of course, groups and advocacy groups and support groups. But there's also was a, I talked to him privately. I said there was a particular family that had faced so much the same thing 20 years earlier, and some family that I knew had worked with it for 20 years and had been brilliant about how they handled things. They just came up with, they were just so good. I mean, if I got a severe mental illness, I would want them to be my parents." And and I said that kind of stuff, and I said, "But I don't know if this person would be willing to talk to you, but I can check." And I checked, and he said, "Absolutely, I'd be glad to talk to them." So this grandfather connected with this man, and they had a conversation, and next thing I heard just a few weeks later was that really they had gotten a whole sense of hope and an idea of how to manage things and sort of how to, some good resource ideas as well as just some ideas about how to be in the family that was just stunning. I mean, just like changed their lives. I mean, obviously they have a long haul, they're going to face things, but That to me was the breaking of a logjam. It didn't clear the whole logjam, but it's kind of like once you assess reality, say, this happened, this is what's going on, now what do we do? And then you are open to having, I mean, this is the assessment of the logjam, the willingness to poke around, the attention that you pay, the listening. You know, I told you today that I read this. In the pursuit of thinking about log jams, I went on the internet and found this conference that had been held 2 years in a row at MIT, and they talked that, and it was about log jams in the world, in the economy, in the in healthcare sector, and really interesting, smart people at the table, and that was the idea, to bring people from all different kinds of disciplines to talk about various log jams. Trying to see if anybody wanted to look that up. Darn, it was called, you could Google it or search it at MIT Collaborative Initiatives. And then Collaborative Initiatives, and it was a synopsis of a symposium. One of them was from November of 2011, and it was called Breaking Logjams. And they gave so many examples, you know, the problem of obesity in the world and in our country, and all the pieces, the logs that have sort of fallen into place to make that feel at the moment so hard to solve. I mean, the reinforcers in the world are overwhelmingly in favor of not healthy food, just coming in, just huge subsidies for unhealthy food and so on, and but it's very complicated to take it apart. Or the problem of feeding and getting medicine to people in the world, and being conceptualized as log jams is just served as a metaphor to help people discuss and to use that metaphor about all these things. I was telling you too that smartest set of comments in there. I mean, just more, way more creative than I ever imagined, because I think I have a, having never been in the military, I don't think I have an accurate view of the creativity. And Admiral Mike Mullen, former chairman of the Joint Chiefs of Staff, was coming up with ideas and told a whole story of solving the problem of getting medical care to the battlefield, where for a long time it was a logjam. They could not solve it. They couldn't solve it. They were trying to have these big planes called C-9s, where they're fabulous for transporting lots of soldiers back to somewhere, but it would take way too long to get them the help they needed. And then in Iraq and Afghanistan, they started putting basically gigantic medical facilities in the field, way more than they needed. And so in a certain way, it was really not working. And they worked and worked and worked until they came up with, to put in the back of almost any plane, almost backpack-sized intensive care units that you could, like a mobile intensive care unit, and it really showed immediate results. So it was a logjam that took not just years, but several wars to figure out. And then looking back on it, it's a real success story. So those are the things where I personally, because of the way my mind works, I find hearing that kind of story give me hope going into tomorrow. To see this next consultation on the next patient that I have that's stuck. Because really, you can kind of survey it. And what we usually do wrong, I think, is we misinterpret and we apply things before we know if they fit. And our models make us do that. I mean, this is what I think is brilliant right now about the fact that not only is there DBT gathering more evidence in the treatment of borderline personality disorder, but also mentalization-based therapy and schema-focused therapy and STEPS therapy of just using skills model and transference-focused therapy. The fact that there are lots of different models trying to do this, I want all of them to succeed. I want all of them to get great data. And then create a surge in a way so that you can then look across at all of them and realize there's a lot of ways to skin a cat. There's a lot of different things you can bring to bear. It's complicated. I mean, it'd be simpler if everything was in one model, but I don't think it is. And the data isn't all there yet, and the data's always a little... Practitioners in the field are always needing stuff before the data comes.
So that's where I would take you next, Charlie. So I'm just thinking of the this may be a little further than where you're at right this second, but you almost were saying it earlier. What is the 1, 2, 3? Say you are, I guess I would say first, say you're a practitioner. And you are looking at this. Maybe you're not a consultant, but you're the one who's really responsible for having a PD.
Yeah, right.
And not being another log on the problem. You know, like, so if you were just to walk through, you know, what would you do? And I guess same for a family member. You know, you're seeing your loved one heading into a train wreck that really is going to cascade into tremendous pressures and stuckness. Mm-hmm. You know, can you go through and do kind of a 1, 2, 3 type of thing?
Yeah, well, I can probably more like a 1.2, 2.3, 4.7 kind of thing, because I'm not quite at the 1, 2, 3 level of it. But I do feel like one reason I'm trying to do this tonight is that this is something I do. I do it all the time. I think I do it well, but I haven't figured out exactly how to articulate it yet. But it has to do with taking on a stuck situation. So first of all, I would say it's a perspective to have. It's to have the perspective that nobody wanted this logjam. Nobody. And because there is a tendency once these logjams happen to blame yourself, to blame other people, nobody wanted these logjams. Nobody would have wanted to be in it. And so it's almost like bigger than each person. And and to have the perspective that it came about one log at a time, and that, you know, so therefore it can be dismantled a log at a time. It can be shifted. There are forces in it that make it seem like everybody and everything is immobilized. You've had three consultants, you've had three hospitalizations, you've had two different therapists, you've had 14 different medications, and things are still stuck. My point of view is you just didn't get there yet, you know. Mm-hmm. And how do you get that next thing informed by a perspective that says, okay, there's a lot of logs here, and we're all part of it. You know, nobody is divorced from this. I mean, I guarantee you, tomorrow, 1 hour into the meeting that I'm going to be in doing a consultation, I'm going to be part of the problem. I just am. There's no question about it, because I'm going to take a certain point of view, and I'm going to take a certain opinion. I'm going to ask a certain question, and it's going to, you know, go one way and not another way. So it's kind of like it's like that idea in DBT about the fallibility agreement. Try to get out of being defensive, because I think it just kills everything. Mm-hmm. It's kind of like, okay, and just see, we're all in a logjam now. So first thing, you know, step one is more perspective than any action. Mm-hmm. It's kind of like step back and realize we're all part of it. We're all part of the problem. And is there a way we can all put our heads together, or as many as possible, and be part of coming up with a solution? So second thing I would think is to realize that most addition of most logs from the very first one are one way or another an example of a mismatch. So step two is also a perspective. It's what are you looking for? It's one mismatch. It's somebody starts doing something. They're 17 years old. And somebody doesn't understand it and reacts to it in a narrow way because it's provoking anxiety. It's upsetting. And they do something. Like I've had people before that at a certain moment somebody figures out, it looks like it's borderline personality disorder. The parents do some research and they really are doing everything they can, and they decide, wow, there's a hospital program we know of that treats borderline personality disorder, and they're really good at DBT, and so let's do the hospitalization. Well, lo and behold, the person has no interest in being hospitalized, and they forgot to consult with the 17-year-old and make them part somehow of the decision, even if it's forced on them eventually. So in a way, accidentally, in the rush to help, there's also but on the other hand, you feel you have to do something. So it's kind of like realizing that you want to start right now to try to minimize the mismatches, to stop adding logs unless you absolutely have to, because life is going down. And that can require a lot of tolerance and a lot of support from professionals or other families to be able to kind of hold steady, because sometimes movement may happen. So that's sort of step two, I would think. And then I would start surveying the jam, look at all the different pieces, find out that, did you know that Aunt so-and-so killed herself last year? And did you know that Aunt so-and-so happened to be the favorite aunt of this kid? And did you know that this kid actually wanted to go to the funeral but couldn't make it because of some family situation? And what about the fact that he now resents people in the family forever because of that? And sort of like, you know, all these things, one thing at a time, where reality just has to be appreciated. And sometimes if you can appreciate it and validate it, it loosens it up. But it requires sort of seeing it. And then the other thing, Kelly, I'd say is that at a certain point, I think in any treatment approach, but also just in life approach, I have to do this with my boys when I get stuck with them one way or another, is at a certain point when you feel like you've got some perspective, you've got some ideas, you're trying to be, you know, see that things have a reason and you don't want to impose a mismatch, you try things. I think that it's just the trial and error, and I think when you unpack a logjam, like any problem in life, I think you have to try to move this and try to move that. But the thing is, you have to try and figure out, how long do I persist in trying to move this thing? How long do I persist with this medication? I mean, I have to deal with this as a psychiatrist. You know, now we've added a third medication to somebody. Now, the tendency is to just leave medications on board and then add a fourth one, especially if people go in and out of hospitals. But there's no evidence showing that four medications does a thing. But each of them is supposed to do something, and it's just that you hate to take something off, but it can be very encouraging to take something off, and it doesn't work. So it's kind of like moving this, but then stopping moving it, moving this, then stopping it. Somewhere in that pile are three or four key logs. It might be helping someone get a job. It might be, as I did with one patient, help her decide to give up on the car that she was trying to get repaired with every cent she had, which was going to make it impossible for her to put gas in it, which was going to make it impossible for her to go to her volunteer job, which was the one thing she was really living for. And it's kind of like, at a certain point when the car broke down, it was figuring out through trial and error discussion, hey, how about this? What if you tried that? What if you tried this? While she was feeling terrible and things were desperate, deciding to put my weight behind a certain log, which was, I suggest you give up your car and look at what that opens up for you. Now you don't have any car payments. You don't have gas. You don't have this. You've been wanting to go to school for a long time. You're on a bus route of that school that you wished you could go to. What about maybe this is sort of the universe's way of telling you this is the moment to say goodbye to the car and say hello to applying to school. And even though, if I told you the whole story of this person, the log jam was as big as almost any log jam we deal with. I mean, she was really stuck for a long time, had every reason to not think she would ever make it or find it worth making it. I mean, this kind of little movement actually gave her quite a movement forward. It was sort of like we found almost by chance the right log. And that made a lot of the other logs just not seem so heavy. So I think part of it is, so it's the big perspective that we're all stuck in a log jam. Can we all collaborate to get out of it? Can we get as many people at the table, or as many, you know, like my, as many people willing to brainstorm as possible? And can we see that there's been a lot of mismatches and not keep adding more if we can avoid it? Can we be really sensitive to the pressures that are going on there? Can we start poking around and trying different things out and yet have the sensitivity to know when it's time to get off of one of those attempts and say, you know what, that was a good try. Let's try something else. And in a way that conveys, you know, we're going to figure it out one step at a time, but it's going to take, you know, moving some other logs around now. So I think the trial and error thing, and I think what you said earlier, if there is a way that you can generate a surge, whether it's resources, financial resources or family resources, meaning emotional and affiliative resources or support or someone in a state agency that just happens to be the right person for this person, or something like that. I mean, working in a state system, I see this. This is what I just feel like. State systems can be very stuck, and it can be very frustrating. But there's also a lot of things sitting around if you're paying attention, and if you keep thinking there's going to be a solution, something turns up, you know. So, I mean, that's. you know, like this grandfather talking to this other man. I mean, who knew that was going to be a big answer? You don't. It's not in any treatment manual that you would do that.
Right.
It's just being, it's thinking more metaphorically and it's thinking collaboratively.
And creating a certain type of, I think the other thing embedded in here is the big picture. It may take a long time of poking. You know, that is hard to bear. So I think, you know, somebody, and there's the other thing that's in here, I think, is the fact that you have done it so much. So when you sit down, you do trust the process. You know, you've seen it, and there's a patience with the process, I think, that's also probably potential in itself. You know?
That's true. It helps to believe in the process of not immediately coming to the answer, because other people sitting in the room an hour into a meeting can think, this is a waste.
Mm-hmm.
What is the point of all this? But actually the stage is set. If you get it, like, think of the thing. I mean, this is not intended to be a promotional statement about the training that you and I did together. But when we did that training in Chicago, of people who are already pretty experienced at DBT, I mean, it felt like somehow we managed to create a very collaborative atmosphere. And people, and it wasn't any one thing that you and I did that led to some what seemed like pretty good short-term outcomes when we heard from people afterwards. But
right.
It was more, there was something about the collaborative, non-punitive, non-judgmental, creative, but also kind of continuing to look and continuing to try and have some structure. It seemed like that atmosphere, that's a completely different conversation, but it intersects with this, because it's that kind of atmosphere that you want to generate in your family for even 5 minutes to solve a tough problem, or in a team, a DBT team, an interdisciplinary team, a team of any model, or you know, a big community consultation around, I've had consultations recently where we have somebody from the jail, somebody from the fire department, somebody from the police department, the director of the emergency room, and the nurse from the emergency room, somebody from an inpatient unit, and then a whole community team, and the client, and a family member. And it's like, when you have that group of people together, at first it's intimidating. It feels like this is a mess. But if you can create an atmosphere where people's contributions are valued, that's a way of generating more flow in the logjam. It's a way you can actually generate it if you can get it going. And I think for advocacy organizations, you know, like NEABPD and other ones that get families together and get professionals and families together and get, you know, and getting clients and professionals, and you get sort of a certain critical thing going that makes it seem like, wow, once it's going, you can solve a lot of things. And so I think it's like creating a surge, and I don't mean like the one in Iraq, but that was another surge, actually, of resources. But it's sort of more like generating a surge, a critical mass of willingness, collaboration, and looking at reality, and looking at the logjam, and trying to take this piece and then this piece and this piece. And if you believe it can happen, I think it'll happen more often than if you don't believe it'll happen, if you just go in.
Well,
yeah.
Charlie, we're just coming
right
up
at the
on
end.
Time. Yeah.
This is one time when I feel like saying, like, cook, click and clack the Tappert Brothers. I think I may have said this before, but everybody who's listening has now just spent another perfectly good hour of their lives listening to this. And you just never know. I mean, who knows? Even this discussion might have triggered some thought here or there, and I hope that we'll hear from people through NEABPD, just any feedback. about it, including if this kind of conversation, because it lacked some of the structure of other conversations. Whether that's helpful or not is helpful, but mm-hmm. I would love
yeah,
to
I think
hear.
It's important. I mean, to me at least, I think this exact space to extend your thinking. You know, you're one of the. I've said this before to you, but I think you're one of the better consultants in the universe. And the more you can articulate what it is you do so that the rest of us can start to do it, the better. So
it's very kind of you to say that. You don't know a thing about the consultants off of the earth, though, you know. So. No, I'm kidding. But that's very nice of you to say. But I do think it is getting – it's hard to get at these kind of things. Mm-hmm. But I think everybody has been part of something like this in their lives, where they've been a place where people are collaborative, non-judgmental, pushing for a solution, not giving up. It's a log jam, and they keep trying different logs, and they keep trying to raise the water level. And, you know, very often that leads to the solution. Anyway, so we'll say goodbye to everybody for the summer from the point of view of this show, and hope it was useful to some people. And check out that website if you can find it, where the MIT Collaborative Initiatives are listed, and they had 2 years in a row where they focused on log jams, breaking log jams, and has some really cool ideas.
Great.
Okay.
Great, Charlie. Well, have a good summer.
Thank you. You too.
Aww.
You too. And to Perry.
We'll see everybody in the fall.
Everybody.
Kelly and Charlie, thank you so much. And on behalf of all of our listeners, we wish you a wonderful summer and look forward to connecting the dots in September. So thank
you. Thank you. Reconnecting the dots.
Reconnecting the dots. New title. Great.
Okay. Thanks, Perry.
Thank you so much.
All right.
Bye-bye.
Take care. Bye-bye.